I was trying to decide whether I should talk about, I don't do Spintronics, as I'm sure many of you know. I was trying to decide whether to talk about organic electronics or biosensors. Saw that Steve talked about biosensors today, so I thought I might have done that. But I decided to do something else. I had been, for a variety of reasons that I won't bore you with, thinking about some old work that I did many years ago. Beautiful physics that I thought maybe I would try to tell some of you about today. The first question I have here is, how many people in this audience are under 50? Good, I have an audience. See, this work was done nearly 30 years ago. Okay? And if you were under 20, 30 years ago, you probably didn't know about this, right? I mean, so only a few people perhaps have heard about this work. It's about this. Despite the fact that this is 30 years ago, this is a single crystal of this material. Okay? It's made of terrible things. It's made of mercury and arsenic hexafluoride. It's a salt. Okay? If you do a simple, I'll try to define that a little bit better, X-ray diffraction study of this crystal, you'll come up with a structure that looks like this. The stoichiometry is approximately 3 mercuries to 1 of these arsenic hexafluoride. The mercury atoms are in linear chains, and there are 2 sets. There's a set of chains on the top here that go this way, and then another set of chains that go the opposite way. Okay? These distances are quite large. This distance here is 7.5 angstroms. This distance here is over 12 angstroms. So these chains are rather widely separated. On the other hand, the mercury atoms are pretty close together. All right, so I'll show you they're but much closer together than the mercury atoms in mercury itself. Now, the interesting thing is that if you really look at the structure and you measure this distance, you find that the distance here is not commensurate with the lattice. Incommensurate structure. All this was done, as I said, in the period 1977 to 1979, and there were many people who contributed to this. Some of them are gone. You'll see the hand here of Gen Shirani, whose name I'm sure many of you know, neutron scattering, perhaps the father of neutron scattering in this country, but certainly one of the main players. Vic Emery did a lot of theory on this. Arnold Enestein was working with us. This work was done at the University of Pennsylvania, and a lot of the experiments that were done, he contributed to. And as you know, all 3 of these people have since died. It's a picture, but if you're interested, you can look at this. This looks like a crystal, okay? A piece of solid. It looks like a crystal. It's not. It's a liquid. And I'll show you that. Now, here are the numbers that make it interesting. Okay? The tetragonal unit cell, A and B are equal, and they're 7.54 angstroms. This distance is 2.64 between the mercury atoms. If you simply divide 7.54 by 2.64, you don't get 3. Okay? What did I do with it? You get 2.856. So these mercury chains are not commensurate with the lattice in which they sit. There's many consequences. If they're not commensurate with the lattice in which they sit, there's translational variance. You can move them. Okay. Now, the other thing that's interesting, sort of amusing, interesting, that distance, when you measure the temperature dependence of the structure, is constant. This distance is constant, temperature independent. This distance is not. It's an ionic salt. When you cool it, it has a coefficient of thermal expansion. So when you cool the sample, mercury comes out the ends. Okay? And you raise the temperature, it goes back in. It can move because it has this translational symmetry. And in fact, as I will show you, it's a one-dimensional liquid. So the first thing, then, is this is the only example that I know of. We've done a lot of work. As I think you know, I've been interested in one-dimensional systems for a long time. This is the only system that I know of where one actually can see lattice dynamics that are one-dimensional and electronic properties that are one-dimensional both. But in some sense, it's the lattice dynamics that are, in a way, more unusual and more special. So let's take a look at those to begin with. So these are neutron scattering data. If you scan in the A star C star plane, you see a sheet of scattering, which is telling us that you have here random order between the different chains. If you look at the phonon spectra, you look at the phonon spectrum, say, from a Bragg point that corresponds to the lattice, you get a velocity of sound that corresponds to this slope. And there's a nice Bragg peak here, of course, because it's a crystal. If, on the other hand, you go to this point 2.86 corresponding to this unusual stoichiometry, and you measure the phonon spectrum, it has a completely different slope than this one. This is much more stiff than this one. The two velocities of sound are roughly a factor of two apart. And this again comes about and because of the fact that these mercury chains are incommensurate with the lattice. Now, you all remember and you all know, I'm sure, and this argument is very well known, that there is no such thing as long-range order in truly one-dimensional systems. The argument for a ferromagnet is very trivial. You have the ground state with all the spins up. If you put in one spin flip, you can put that anywhere, and so the entropic term will always kill the long-range order. That means that if what I just told you is true, for example, looking at this at these two phonon spectra, if these really are one-dimensional systems, then they can't have long-range order. Now, you can calculate the liquid structure. It means it's a liquid. It means these chains are not really solid. It means they must be a liquid. There's no long-range order. And one can calculate the liquid structure factor. Richard Spall, who was a student at that time, did that. It has this simple form, which when you plot it up, looks like this. One-dimensional chain, which is necessarily a liquid, does not have Bragg peaks, It has a series of maxima. They get broader and broader and broader as you go out in K-space, and they're described by this function. We were actually very proud of having solved this problem, and when Richard was writing up his thesis, he was doing some literature search, and he found that Schrödinger solved the problem in 1922 for the first time. Nevertheless, this is what it should look like. These curves here have to do, we should really just look at this one, the solid curve, because, as I said, the distance between the mercury atoms in this case is independent of temperature. That means that the potential is basically symmetric. Okay? No fourth order terms are so small that it's harmonic. And so one would expect this kind of thing. Now you can actually check this with experiment. The way we did this was to beautiful collaboration with a colleague at the University of Pennsylvania at the time, Takeshi Igami, who was using energy dispersive X-ray scattering. Take an X-ray tube. Normally, what you do is you use the copper K-alpha line or one of the narrow lines to do standard X-ray diffraction. What you want to do here is to use the broadband background, or you could do it with synchrotron radiation. But we want to use energy dispersive X-ray scattering. Actually, that reminds me. That was the experiment was suggested by Shlomo Alexander when he came to visit us at Penn, and we went on and did it at his suggestion. And this is what one sees. The solid curve is a fit to the predicted structure, liquid structure factor that I showed you just a moment ago. We had to do some background corrections, of course, and these are the data. The fit is beautiful. This is a one-dimensional lattice dynamic system in which these mercury chains are in fact disordered and look like, and are therefore a liquid. Now, if you remember how that goes, and it was implicit on that little argument that I gave for the ferromagnet, even though you don't have long-range order in such a system, you have very long coherence lengths. Okay, and it's well known there are a number of magnetic examples where the coherence lengths are sufficiently long that eventually the interchain coupling will give rise to long-range order in the system. That happens here as well, and one other point I wanted to make. When we understood that this was in fact not a solid, that it was really a liquid, the one-dimensional chains were a liquid, Ganshirani said to me, there's something wrong. Because when you do the X-ray scattering, simple diffraction, it looks like there's a Bragg peak. But there cannot be a Bragg peak if you have really got a liquid. And the answer is, they went back and they did the experiment very carefully with very high resolution. There is no Bragg peak here. The scattering that one sees in this sheet comes from basically the phonons. And the X-ray detector is just not doesn't have the energy resolution to see that. But it's truly a liquid. There's no Bragg peak, but these phonons are describing. They're not phonons even. I guess that's not even fair. If it's not a solid, they're not phonons. But they are the elementary excitations of this one-dimensional liquid that one sees through this through the liquid structure factor. Now, not so surprisingly, as I said just a moment ago, if you have these very long coherence links in these chains, they will tend to weakly interact. And eventually, one expects that the system will collapse into or will obtain long-range order. That's what happens here. In this case, at about 120 degrees Kelvin, what happens is that these mercury chains order in an antiphase array. Okay? Not all the on successive chains, the mercury atoms are not straight, but they're out of phase by 90 degrees. And you can see a picture of that here. This is what K-space looks like, or Q-space looks like. These are the one-dimensional phonons that are coming up. At higher temperatures, there is no restoring force along this direction, but below 120 degrees, you begin to pick up this order, which gives you an energy gap here. That energy gap turns out to be, when measured by neutron scattering with high resolution, that energy gap turns out to be 1.5, equivalent of KT of 1.5 degrees. And the Bragg peak that corresponds to that order grows as a function of temperature in intensity and the energy gap. Of course, this is a real, probably a second order, real second order phase transition. There's not enough data here to really show that, but it comes on continuously. It's a phase-on gap, 1.5 degrees Kelvin. And from that, of course, you can infer by just this analogy, the Debye temperature intra-chain is about 600 degrees, as I'll show you. The Debye temperature perpendicular is sufficiently small that 600 degrees times that gives you about 100. If you have a one-dimensional chain, then you expect to have a contribution to the specific heat, which is linear in T, right? Normally in a solid, when you make a plot like this, C over T versus T squared, you expect, if it's a metal, you have a linear term in the specific heat that comes from the electron gas, and a T cubed term, which comes from the lattice. But now you have to be a little bit careful here, because I've got these one-dimensional chains. Their Debye temperature is sufficiently low that this could be, and in fact it is. I mean, we know this is a metal. I'll tell you more about it. But we also know what the density of states is from the night shift. And the contribution of the electronic contribution of the specific heat would be unobservable on this plot. So what we've got here is a linear term in the heat capacity, which comes from the one-dimensional lattice dynamics that I showed you on the phonon spectrum just a moment ago. These measurements were done by Dan Moses sitting here in the long ago. He also had more hair then than he has now. You'll notice that this extrapolation, which gives us this one-dimensional Debye temperature of 540 degrees Kelvin, when you get to sufficiently low temperatures, dies away. But you expect that, because there's a gap in the because of this antiphase ordering, this phase-on gap. It's no longer one-dimensional when you get down to temperatures comparable to that gap. That gap was 1.5 degrees Kelvin. So when you get down to temperatures below 1.5 degrees Kelvin, the 1D lattice dynamics converts to a three-dimensional lattice dynamics. And indeed, one can take these data, we know this gap, and we can fit this contribution, and the best fit gives us a really good agreement between the measured phase-on gap here and the temperature and the dying of the one-dimensional lattice dynamic. As I said, this is the only example that I know of. I think it's the only known example where the one-dimensional lattice dynamics are shown so clearly. Now, this looks like a metal. It has a nice golden reflectance. And it is a metal. And if you measure that reflectance at normal incidence, just take a crystal of this kind, one sees this characteristic Drude-like reflection. It, in fact, can be fit very, very beautifully by simple Drude theory. Plasma frequency here is about 4.8 electron volts. Standard sort of analysis that you've seen many times. What is quite interesting is that in this case, one can find on these crystals different facets. So you can do scattering from the top, where the chains are this way, and you're scattering here. But you can also come in at some angle, at some various angles, depending on the different facets of the crystal. And what you see when you do that is that when you come in with light polarized perpendicular to the chains, okay, you get this very nice Drude-like reflectance. But as you come in at different angles, that disappears. And in fact, if you come in at right angle, at 90 degrees, it looks like an insulator. There's no sign whatever of the metallic behavior. So this is telling us that these chains are not only one-dimensional in their lattice dynamics, but they're one-dimensional in their electronic properties as well. You can fit that. This is standard stuff. Just take the standard Fresnel equations and put in the anisotropic dielectric function that you would expect if you had a one-dimensional metal and an insulator in the perpendicular direction. And from these various facets, if you just take the data from the normal incidence, you can predict all of the others. So as far as we can tell, these chains are one-dimensional metals as well as one-dimensional liquids in the sense of their lattice dynamics. The transport properties are really quite interesting, and in a way had never been properly explained. Let me show you what I'm plotting here. So this is the parallel resistance when you are putting current along the direction of the chain. This is of course a log-log plot. The resistivity at room temperature is quite low, about 10 to the minus 4 ohm centimeters, 10 to the 4th Siemens per centimeter. As you cool down, it goes up by many orders of magnitude. And the curious thing here is that if you plot these low temperature data on a linear plot, there's just no sign of a residual resistance. The anisotropy is quite large, about a factor of 100. But the temperature dependence is almost the same, so probably this anisotropy is not intrinsic, probably due to some defects because the temperature dependence is so nearly the same. But the lack of residual resistivity is particularly interesting because these crystals are not at all perfect. Okay, they cannot be perfect because these chains are liquids. Okay? And because if you cool the sample down, mercury is coming out. And that means that there are charged impurities that are not compensated because the arsenic hexafluoride has a negative charge. So the existence of the apparent absence of residual resistivity is non-trivial and indeed puzzling. We did a lot of work on this to try to figure it out. It's probably too late in the day to go into all those details. But temperature dependence is very strong, even at the resistivity, conductivity, even at these very lowest temperatures. In addition, the magnetoresistance is interesting. This is an H squared plot, so this is delta rho over rho plotted as a function of field. On a log scale, and this is the h squared, the slope of h squared. Only at the very lowest magnetic fields does one get to a classical, so to speak, magnetoresistance. And if you analyze the slope there, one comes up with a mobility from the Hall relation. From the from the resistivity, you get a mobility of 5 times 10 to the 4th. From the magnetoresistance, you get a mobility even higher. So this difference is perhaps interesting, but the simple fact is that the mobility of the electrons in these one-dimensional chains, where you have such a high degree of anisotropy, is sufficiently high that the mean free path is macroscopic, approaching 50 to 100 microns. Now, I said this before, but let me emphasize it again. Two different ways. First thing that one should do here is to do a chemical analysis. And that was done very carefully, and the chemical analysis, as almost must be, you have to have charge neutrality. So the chemical analysis says 3-1. Okay? But the structural analysis tells us that the two different links are incommensurate. That means that there are something like 6% charge defects in the crystal. 6% charge defects in a one-dimensional system where backscattering immediately causes localization is what you would expect. I should say that better. With 6% charge defects in such a one-dimensional crystal, you would expect localization. You would not expect conductivities that are approaching 10 to the 8th and without any residual resistivity. And of course, the same kind of conclusion in a more qualitative way comes about when I tell you, as I did, that as you cool the sample, you actually see little droplets of mercury coming out and they go back in, and imperfections are there. When you put on a magnetic field, what you find is that the temperature dependence of the resistivity doesn't change. The only thing that happens is you get a magnetic field-induced residual resistivity. If you subtract that off, the curves fall exactly on the same temperature dependence. Instead of changing the temperature dependence, you create with a magnetic field an apparent residual resistivity. Now, there are a number of interesting questions here. Why is there no residual resistivity, and what's the mechanism for this field-induced residual resistivity? And I will explain that, but there's no theory that really explains that. I will try to explain it in the context of the Fermi surface. These are two sets of one-dimensional chains. If you had one set of such one-dimensional chains, you'd have a series of the Fermi surface would be planar. Okay. If you have two sets of chains, you can have Fermi surface this way and a Fermi surface this way. What I'm showing you here are for different band fillings, and from what we know of the chemistry and the number of electrons, you'd expect the Fermi energy to be this dotted line or this dotted line, and there's more curvature here than here, because one is assuming in this little calculation a stronger interchain coupling and here a weaker interchain coupling. But the important point is that if you apply a magnetic field into the perpendicular to the chains, then what you tend to do is you tend to drive electrons around the Fermi surface. Okay. So the analysis that was done was based on that. The argument that was made was, for some reason, come back to, when there's no magnetic field, the area of the Fermi surface is almost completely dominated by the flat sheets of the one-dimensional chains. And evidently, under those circumstances, there's no backscattering, because the residual resistivity is going to zero. When you put on a magnetic field, you run the electrons around the Fermi surface, and at this point, or at this point here, your wave function is mixed. It's half on one set of chains and half on the other set of chains. You get scattering. So if you make just the flat assumption without any justification, and even despite, I would say, physical intuition, that defects and impurities are not effective in the backscattering along the chains, and they only become effective when you go to the corners as you put on the magnetic field, then you can explain the data. You get, in that way, a field-dependent residual resistivity. The electrons all have to pass through these corners. But when the field is zero, the fraction of the area of the Fermi surface that is on the corners is sufficiently small that it's really unimportant. But of course, it begs the question. I mean, you can explain it that way, and this is a straightforward thing that one can show, one can calculate, but the origin of, or the reason for, the absence of backscattering on the chains in the presence of 6% of defects is not trivial and is not understood. Now, there's one possibility. You know, in the 70s and in particular 70s and 80s, there was a lot of work done on trying to understand, using renormalization group techniques, what happens with one-dimensional chains when there are pulsive interactions, when there are attractive interactions, under a variety of conditions. And there are conditions, theoretical conditions, where if you have attractive interactions, you can expect, I should say, that the residual that the resistivity will go to zero, that one-dimensional localization is avoided, and the Pyrrhus instability is avoided. But these were, I would say, very esoteric theoretical papers, not in any way particularly not transparent, but also not an attempt to really explain these data, nor an attempt to apply to this particular kind of a structure. But it's true that the resistivity does go to zero, that in spite of the fact that we have defects, we don't have one-dimensional localization, and there is no Pyrrhus instability, even at the very lowest temperatures. So, this is one of my favorite pieces of work, okay? Did it almost 30 years ago. We have one-dimensional chains. We have one-dimensional lattice dynamics. The only time ever. We have one-dimensional electronic systems. We have no residual resistivity. Remarkable stuff. And the crystal still exists. A lot of people contributed to this. I made the comment here that this is not my most cited work. Nobody seems to remember this, but it's one of the things that I'm most proud of. This, the fundamental work on one-dimensional phenomena and solids that are shown in this mercury chain combo is really quite, the whole set of data are quite remarkable. And again, let me acknowledge a number of people. I mentioned Gen Cerani and Vic Emery and Arnold Enestein earlier. These crystals were grown by a friend of ours, Andrew McGee. He recently retired from the University of Pennsylvania. We had a lot of help in thinking about these problems in the early 80s or late 70s by Mark Asbell and Meyer Vager. Richard Spall was the one who did most of the transport work. And who solved this for the liquid structure factor of one dimension, only to find out later that he'd been beaten by 50 years by Schrödinger, but that's not so bad. And of course, I was collaborating with Alan McDiarmid at the time. Dan Moses did all those beautiful specific heat data. Qibong Li was one that was involved deeply in this energy dispersive X-ray scattering. So it's the end of a week, a subject with which most of you are unfamiliar, but perhaps I've entertained you for a few minutes on something that most of you have never heard of and the rest of you have forgotten about. Thank you. You'd expect all of those things would be expected. Absolutely. The giant cone anomaly you would expect because that's the precursor to the pyral transition. We understand these problems really deeply, right? So I'm looking for a way out. The way out is to simply say if the interactions are attractive and just in the right part of the interaction space, you can avoid all those phenomena, but it seems remarkable. Okay? I mean, it is remarkable. Perfectly nested. Yes, Per.
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying in the picture that car resets. The mercury's in that. And presumably, it has some filling fraction of there's an incommensurate number of electrons per mercury.
Right.
Well,
they're screened. Agreed. Right.
Then
it would have no. Right.
No,
wait. There would be no defects. But off to the side, there are going to be some missing, that's right, missing negative charges. Because the stoichiometry, when you measure it chemically, is 1:1. It can't be at all temperatures. At room temperature, it's 1:1. As close as one could measure from chemical analysis, and you know, we could argue that one a little bit too. But right, but as close as we could measure using standard chemical analysis to measure how much mercury and how much arsenic it is, it's 1:1. But the structure is not commensurate. Okay, and then I cool it down, and the mercury distance does not change, but the arsenic pentafluoride shrinks. The lattice shrinks. Well, yeah, you do the chemistry at room temperature, presumably that's why. I don't know. Yeah. Right. Well, but the drops are finite in size. You see them. You see little droplets form. If you look under a microscope, cool it down, liquid nitrogen, and look under a microscope, you see the. I remember seeing them. you could imagine, but it's not atomic scale, or presumably not. Yes.
I'm
I think I have the only existing crystals. If there was something interesting, if there's something interesting to do, I'd be willing to part with them. But all this work was done long ago, it would be non-trivial to start up a process to growing those crystals again.
One historic question. You said this was not your most widely cited work.
Right.
Was it controversial? Or
no, not at all. I mean, you know, again, Shirani and Vic Emery. Well, again, Shirani was a remarkable man. He demanded an awful lot out of physics. It had to be right, and when he did something, it was right. So there was never any question of the validity of those features. But it's like many things in science, beautiful thing, but it doesn't take you out of it. It stays, keeps you there. Well, just that. So we got distracted as well. Yeah.